Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. It's spring 1993 and an early morning in Berkeley, California. Lowell Bergman quickly walks through his house. He's wearing pajama bottoms and a faded sweatshirt. He's carrying a folder that's stuffed with documents. Bergman enters his study, pulls the door closed behind him. Sunlight's pouring through the windows there. It reflects off the many awards Bergman has received during his career as an investigative journalist. He closes the blinds and sits at his desk. Bergman is 47, and he's been working as a journalist for decades. But the buzz of excitement he feels right now never gets old. It's the tingle a reporter gets when he senses the potential for an explosive story. Bergman begins flipping through his Rolodex. Names and numbers whiz by. They belong to experts, informants, spies. They're the sources that Bergman taps for his work as a producer for 60 Minutes. He reaches the M's and stops. He's found the name. McGuire. Andrew McGuire. He's an old friend and just the expert Bergman needs. Bergman lifts the phone and dials. McGuire quickly picks up.
Hello?
Hey, Andrew, it's Lowell. I know it's a little early on a Saturday, but can you talk?
Yeah, what's up?
Well, I was reading the paper this morning when I hear a thump on my front porch. I go out and there's this crate filled with papers. No sign of who left it, just the documents. And they are very intriguing.
Sounds like someone wants you to go on a fishing expedition.
Yeah, they all but handed me the rod. Bergman pauses, weighing his words. If he tells McGuire any more, there's no turning back. This story, like all great ones, will start to take on a life of its own. It might grow huge, change the world, but it could also stir up a major fight. Bergman swallows and makes a decision. So, Andrew, here's the deal. There's a stamp that says confidential at the top of every page, and two other words, Philip Morris.
Oh, my Lord.
Exactly.
Well, what do the papers say?
That's the problem. I have no idea. We're not talking about memos. It's all schematics, scientific data, charts. So I called you. You're the only expert I know that's up on this stuff. You know, tobacco.
Well, can you describe the documents? What's in front of you right now?
Bergman frowns as he scans the pages. It's just a bunch of numbers. And, well, here's one that stands out. It says ignition propensity.
Okay, all right, great. So that's how a cigarette burns once it's lit. It's the intensity of the flame, duration. Pretty standard, though. Anything else?
No, sorry. That's the only thing that makes any sense to me.
Okay, so I do know a lot about the legal sides of this, but for the technical stuff, you got to talk to someone who's actually been on the inside.
I'm not going to get someone who's on the inside. Where am I going to find someone like that?
Well, actually, I know a guy, a biochemist. He worked for Brown and Williamson in Louisville, ran research and development until they fired him.
At that, Bergman's ears perk up. Fired? For what?
I'm not exactly sure, but if anyone can help you with those documents, it's this guy.
Bergman once again feels the tingle. He can feel the potential of a huge story, and it surges through him with an electric force. He grabs his pen and flips to a blank card from his Rolodex as McGuire continues.
His name's Wiegand, Jeffrey Wiegand. Give him a call. Imagine he's got a few secrets of his own.
Bergman's got a new lead, a box of documents, and that tingle that says he's onto something. But what? He's determined to find out.
American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. In the early 1990s, big tobacco was an all-powerful industry and seemingly invincible. Its products killed scores of Americans each year, but cigarette makers still denied that their products were dangerous, and they kept winning their battles in court. Then in 1993, a Mississippi attorney landed on a promising strategy to hold big tobacco accountable. He enlisted a group of allies, and together, these anti-tobacco lawyers saw a path to victory. But first, they needed proof that cigarette makers knew about the dangers of smoking. The evidence had to come from inside the industry, and any insider who provided information would be taking on an enormous risk. This is Episode 2, The Whistleblowers. It's May 1993 in Memphis, Tennessee. Mike Lewis sits on a plastic visitor's chair at Baptist Central Hospital. Warm breeze drifts into the small hospital room. Lewis is wearing khakis and a blue button-down, but he shivers anyway. Maybe it's a physical response to all the get-well-soon cards lined up on the nightstand. Maybe it's that Jackie Thompson is lying in the hospital bed, looking frail, tired, and too weak to sit upright. Thompson is Lewis's close friend, and for years has felt like a family member. But now she's unrecognizable. Tubes snake across her blanket and lead to her veins and nose. Her skin looks yellowed and stretched over her cheekbones. Her once lustrous brown hair will never return. Lewis attempts a grin and asks Thompson if she's heard the one about the claustrophobic astronaut. The poor guy just needed some space. Thompson rolls her eyes at the corny joke and chuckles. But this triggers a series of coughs that makes Lewis wince. It only reminds him of the unbearable truth. Thompson is dying of lung cancer, and there's nothing he can do about it. He wants to scream or punch something, but he knows there's no point in over-the-top gestures. It's no mystery why Thompson is on her deathbed at only 49 years old. She spent the better part of 30 years puffing two packs of Salem Lights every day. Lewis watches as Thompson gradually closes her eyes. Alarmed, he jumps to his feet, but then he sees her chest continue to rise and fall. The nearby machine continued to beep. Lewis wipes his brow and exhales. Not today. Not now, he thinks. She just needs to rest. He reaches out and gently grips his friend's wrist, heads for the door, but then stops. Something tells him that this might be the last time he'll ever see her alive. In the hallway, Thompson's daughter Alice sits with a cup of tea. Her eyes are ringed with dark circles. She looks up as Lewis approaches, and he says that her mother is resting. Alice nods and dabs at her eyes. She says she doesn't know how she'll manage afterwards. Her mom has health insurance, but they can't afford all the out-of-pocket costs. Lewis begins to speak, but Alice stops him. She knows he wants to help with money, but she can't accept it. Then she begins to cry. Lewis wraps her in a hug, and his mind begins to race as he thinks about how he can help. Then he realizes something. Lewis is an attorney. He knows how the government works. All this medical care, it's not only expensive for people like Alice Thompson, it probably costs the state of Tennessee over $1 million. Plus, Jackie Thompson isn't the only person in the state with lungs charred from years of smoking. Lewis blinks at an idea taking hold in his mind. He pulls away from the hug and tells Alice he's just realized something. He can't explain it all right now, but he thinks there could be a way to get resolution for Alice and her family, and something that would hold the makers of Salem cigarettes accountable. Lewis says he has to go, but he'll be in touch soon. Then he makes his way toward the elevator.
He's walking so fast he almost trips. He has to make a phone call to an old friend, a fellow lawyer he admires and who's never lied to him. He'll tell Lewis directly if his idea is merely crazy or about to change the world. Later that day, Mike Moore sits in his office in Jackson, Mississippi. It's well past time to head home, but Moore is still poring over the legal brief for a local corruption case. Moore is Mississippi's attorney general. When he was elected 5 years ago, he promised to usher in a new era of fairness and accountability. For the 41-year-old with his curly mop of black hair, that's meant taking on some ambitious work, stamping out corruption, supporting civil rights lawsuits, endorsing black politicians. Mississippi has made a lot of progress during his tenure, but there's still plenty of work ahead. As Moore is reading, the telephone rings. His secretary says she has Mike Lewis on the line. Moore smiles and asks to have him put through. Moore has kept in touch with Lewis off and on since their college days at the University of Mississippi. Lewis was a serious but good-natured student, and Moore is happy to see that he's matured into a fine lawyer. But Moore is surprised when Lewis greets him in a muted tone. Lewis tells Moore about his friend, Jackie Thompson, how heartbreaking it's been watching her dying of lung cancer. Lewis says he wants to do something for Thompson's family and for families like hers all over the country. He wants to take the cigarette makers to court. Moore is quiet for several seconds. He's heard lots of stories about people just like Jackie Thompson. But this one, coming from his old friend, has unexpectedly left him feeling wounded. And even though he's an attorney general, Moore feels hopeless. He tells Lewis the blunt truth. Moore would love to see Big Tobacco taken down, but there's little they can do through the courts. Big Tobacco argues that smoking is a voluntary choice. They say it's unfair to hold cigarette makers responsible for the smoker's personal choices. And unfortunately, judges and juries tend to agree. Lewis knows this. The anti-tobacco playbook has never worked, and he feels it never will. But then he asks, what if there's a different way? Moore keeps listening, his interest piqued. Lewis lays out a plan, his voice gaining energy. They could take the individual out of the equation. Treating smokers who are dying of cancer is extremely expensive, Lewis says, and ultimately, it's the state that covers most of these costs. So a state, like Mississippi, could sue the tobacco companies instead of the patients. Mississippi could demand reimbursement for the millions of dollars it spent treating Big Tobacco's customers. All 50 states could get in on this and force cigarette makers to pay billions. And Moore could lead the charge. Moore is dumbstruck. It's a simple idea, elegant, logical. He begins to pace his office. Obviously, the plan isn't bulletproof, no plan is, and Big Tobacco is a united front with limitless money and an army of undefeated lawyers. Meanwhile, the state will need private lawyers that it can't afford. Attorneys would have to work on contingency, says Moore, so if they win, they'd get a big percentage of the settlement. Lewis agrees, all that makes sense. Big Tobacco's legal and financial arsenal is formidable, and no one said this was going to be easy. But Moore still says he wants to get this on the fast track. And he asked Lewis to make one more phone call to someone else Moore wants on the case. Another old classmate of theirs who specializes in cases like this, Richard Scruggs. If they're going to beat Big Tobacco, they'll want help from one of the country's best lawyers. It's late spring 1993. Lowell Bergman walks quietly through a hillside neighborhood in Berkeley. Beside him is his wife, Sharon Tiller. They round a corner, and Tiller remarks that Bergman has been unusually quiet. Bergman gazes into the distance and turns to his wife and apologizes. He tells her that he can't stop thinking about the crate of Philip Morris documents in the study. He's been trying to reach this Jeffrey Wigand guy, but none of his voicemails have been returned, and he still can't make sense of any of the documents. Tiller is a journalist herself, a producer on the PBS documentary series Frontline. She suggests that Wigand's silence could mean he's too scared to talk. Maybe he guesses those Philip Morris documents are hiding something of real significance. Bergman bristles. He knows the documents are significant. That's why he needs Wigand, he says. So go get him, Tiller responds. Bergman exhales, frustrated, says that's what he's trying to do. His wife lays a hand on his shoulder and tells him not to give up, to call again as soon as they get home. When they return through the front door, Bergman heads straight for the phone and dials Wigand's number. This time, he hears a click on the other end. He stammers a hello and then asks if he's speaking to Jeffrey Wigand. There's a long pause. Then a woman's voice comes on and says, he doesn't want to talk to you. Bergman hears another click, then the dial tone. He hangs up, feeling more resolved than ever to speak with Wigand directly. His wife is right. It can take months to connect with the source. And if he fails to reach Weigand by phone, then he'll just have to fly to Louisville and get the job done in person. It's May 1993. The sun beats down on a cheap hotel that's just outside Greenville, Mississippi. Inside one of the hotel rooms, Mike Lewis writes quickly on a small whiteboard. The dry erase marker squeaks as he scribbles. Lewis stops and sniffs. The odor of cigarette smoke lingers in the curtains from a previous guest. Lewis shakes his head. He realizes that in the spirit of today's meeting, he probably should have requested a non-smoking room. Lewis checks his watch. Richard Scruggs is never late. And right as the clock strikes 4, Lewis hears a knock. He opens the door and finds Scruggs standing before him, impeccably dressed as usual. He's wearing a knotted green tie and a smart navy blue suit. His black-framed glasses give him the air of a professor. Lewis thanks Scruggs for meeting him at this out-of-the-way hotel. He needed an inconspicuous location for this very secret meeting. Scruggs tells him not to apologize. He understands completely. Lewis invites him in, and once they're both in the room, Lewis closes the door and locks it. "So, how are you doing, Dickie?" "Honestly, we're going to lose the trial, Mike. I suppose that's to be expected, I guess. You try and fight big tobacco, you end up like every other poor bastard. I just don't know that there's a way to beat them in the courts. I just want to fold my cards, spend the next 2 months sitting on a beach somewhere, far away from here." "Well, sure you don't want to go to, I don't know, maybe another courtroom?" "No, no, I said beach." Lewis strides over to his whiteboard and begins pointing to various sections. "No beaches, not yet. This here is how you are going to get revenge. It's how you're going to beat them once and for all." Scruggs runs a hand through his hair, takes stock of the board. His eyes widen. After a moment, he steps back. "Well, damn, this is genius. I think you might have cracked the code. The tobacco companies say smoking is all about personal decisions." "Yeah, personal decisions. They choose to smoke Marlboros, and if they get cancer, they chose to get it. You can't pin that on Philip Morris. But this isn't a personal choice at all. This changes all of that." "Yeah. We're going after them at the state level on behalf of Mississippi. I don't think the state of Mississippi has ever smoked a single cigarette." "I think it's brilliant, Mike." Lewis can't help but smile. Richard Scruggs is one of the country's top litigators. His praise means something. "So, Dickie, want to help us out?" Scruggs looks away for a moment and then looks back at Lewis with a grin. "Well, I suppose the beach will always be there when I'm done. So yeah, sure, I'll help you. And if Mike Moore is involved, then we've got a real chance. But we still got to build the case. We need evidence. Proof that the companies knew cigarettes were addictive and that they caused cancer. They're not going to admit that. So do you have any sources?" Lewis frowns. He knows his entire plan hinges on this question. "We'll just have to search for the needle in the haystack. If we look hard enough, we'll find someone who's willing to tell the truth."
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's September 29th, 1993, in Louisville, Kentucky. Merrill Williams eases onto the couch of his dimly lit den. It's 10 a.m. on a Wednesday. He picks up the remote and flips through channels until he lands on The Price is Right. He rubs his eyes. This isn't where he pictured himself 3 months ago, when he came out of the ER consumed with a desire to do God's will. Williams leans back and his mind returns to the cardboard boxes stacked in his basement. Each is stuffed with papers that he smuggled out before losing his job as a paralegal. Williams remembers the shock of reading the documents, seeing the irrefutable evidence that the tobacco giant Brown and Williamson knew cigarettes are addictive and knew they cause cancer. Williams ended up hatching a plan. After Williams' heart surgery, God came to him and told him to get a lawyer, one who would help expose B&W's deceptions. Williams found a lawyer, and the man said he'd threaten the tobacco giant with a lawsuit on Williams' behalf, but that was 6 months ago. He hasn't won any big victories since then, and he still clearly isn't strong enough from his surgery to go out and get a new job. That's left him feeling tired and unhappy with himself. He sinks deeper into the couch, a feeling of misery rippling through him. And that's when the phone rings. Remarkably, it's his lawyer, and he gets right to the point. He has bad news. Wyatt Tarrant, his old law firm, filed a lawsuit against Williams this morning. They're aiming to take back all the documents he's got. His lawyer starts to suggest that there are several ways to handle this, but Williams cuts him off and says they shouldn't discuss this any further over the phone. Williams hangs up. His stitched-together heart thumps rapidly in his chest. Brown and Williamson now knows who he is and what he's done. Now they want to crush him. Williams' breath grows short, and he tries to steady himself. He needs to be proactive. If this somehow turns into a criminal investigation, he can't be caught with boxes of confidential legal documents in his possession. His wife and kids sleep here. So Williams rises from the couch and grabs a roll of duct tape from the kitchen. Williams has a friend in Florida who will understand his situation. He'll get the evidence out of his house by shipping it to her. Williams then races to the basement and opens the door, rushing down the stairs as quickly as he can. 5 months later, in February 1994, Lowell Bergman sits on the edge of his bed at the Seelbach Hotel. It's good to finally be here in Lowell. Jeffrey Wigand has continued to ignore Bergman's attempts to contact him, so Bergman got on a plane. He spent the last few days driving around the city, hoping to get a sense of Louisville and its people. This morning, he drove past the Brown and Williamson building, trying to imagine what's happening inside, behind the security guards and closed doors. This is Bergman's job, seeking out clues, all in hopes of a breakthrough. When one happens, investigative reporting feels like the most rewarding job in the world. But breakthroughs don't come easy. Still, Bergman has a few tricks up his sleeve to get around the dead ends, and he's about to try one of those tricks right now. He looks at the clock in his hotel room. It's 12:03 a.m. Bergman picks up the phone and dials Wigand's number. After two rings, he hears a tired man with a New York accent say hello. Bergman feels his chest grow tight. Right now, he must have Wigand on the phone, at long last. Bergman speaks quickly, telling Wigand who he is, what he wants, and that he's flown here from California just for a chance at meeting him. There's a pause on the other end of the line and the sound of shallow breath. Then Wigand's voice returns, furious. He asks Bergman what the hell he thinks he's doing calling in the middle of the night. Bergman knows he can't let this spin out of control, so he tells Wigand the truth. This is an old trick among journalists. If someone's not returning your calls, call them at midnight. They'll probably be asleep and will pick up the phone. It's a last resort, but it works. Wigand is quiet. Bergman decides to break the silence. He says that if Wigand is curious to meet him, he'll be waiting in the lobby of the Seelbach Hotel tomorrow at 11 a.m. There's another long pause. Then Bergman hears a sigh. Wigand says, okay, then hangs up. Bergman puts down the phone and leans back, feeling optimistic. Wigand sounded exhausted, not just because he was woken up late at night. Bergman gets the sense that there's a lot weighing down Jeffrey Wigand. Hopefully he's finally ready to unburden himself. Bergman switches off the light and crawls into bed. In 11 hours, he'll find out if his hunch is correct. It's the next morning, and 10 minutes past 11. Lowell Bergman sits in the lobby of the Seelbach, waiting for Jeffrey Wigand. Bergman gazes around at this grand old hotel, with its polished marble floors and wide, elegant staircase. Then he sighs. Bergman's been here for nearly an hour, and still, Wigand is nowhere to be found. Maybe he thinks this busy hotel was the wrong place to meet. There are people in every direction. Bergman wonders if Wigand saw the crowds and got spooked. He looks down, curses under his breath. Meeting here was probably a bad choice. Right then, he hears someone approach. Bergman turns, sees a stocky man with gray hair, patchy and uncombed. He looks drained and nervous. Bergman stands and smiles. There's no doubt in his mind that this is Jeffrey Wiegand. Jeffrey? That's me. Bergman reaches out to shake hands. Wiegand ignores the handshake, takes a seat. Bergman sits too.
Well, thanks for seeing me today.
You shouldn't thank me yet. Look, if you're looking for a source for some expose, you'll just have to keep looking. B&W is done with me, and I'm done with them. I don't need guys like you calling me late at night. You scared my wife.
Yeah, I respect that, Jeffrey.
Trust me. Actually, I don't trust you. But you came all this way, and I live about 5 minutes from here, so here I am.
Bergman steadies his breath. He's met with plenty of sources who are deeply uncomfortable with journalists. But all it takes is a little time and a little conversation.
I get that, too. Look, I just wanted to know if you could clarify something for me. What happened at Brown and Williamson? I mean, what were the circumstances of your leaving?
Wiegand's mouth curls into a mask of rage.
Oh, I didn't leave. I ran R&D there for over 4 years, then they fired me. They practically dragged me out of my lab. I've been out of work ever since. But why? Why'd they fire you? They didn't want a good scientist. They wanted a good soldier, a guy who never talks back. I just couldn't do it. I mean, I'm not perfect, but I have principles. Look, they're hiding things, and people are dying because of it.
Bergman's eyes light up, but then Wiegand leans back in his chair and folds his hands.
But I really can't get into any of that.
Why not? I signed a confidentiality agreement.
And that's binding until when?
Until I drop dead. And if they find out I violated it, I could lose everything. Tobacco companies go after people in ways you don't want to know about. So look, I've said too much already, and I should go.
Wait, Jeffrey, wait, okay? I get that you can't talk about Brown and Williamson, but what about this?
Bergman reaches into his bag and hands Wiegand a couple of documents. He watches as Wiegand's eyes go wide.
So you understand any of that?
Of course I do.
It shows they were developing a cigarette that would go out if the smoker didn't take a drag for a minute or two. You know, fire safety. Gosh, this is amazing. Philip Morris was way ahead of us. Ah, I wish I could take this home. Go ahead, take it home, please. And listen, if you need a job, let me give you one. I'll pay you to read all those documents. All you have to do is tell me what they mean.
Wiegand furrows his brow.
Well, there's nothing I can do about Brown and Williams. But maybe I can do something. Looks like Philip Morris was close. I'm sure they could have put out a safer product on the shelves, but they didn't. So if I can help make them pay for that, I will.
Wiegand stands up.
Now, I really do have to go.
He extends his hand, and Bergman shakes it. And then Wiegand disappears into the crowd. It's early evening, March 1994. Merrill Williams stands in an alleyway in Louisville, Kentucky. Rain pours down from dark, swollen clouds overhead. Williams is drenched, but he's careful to keep a folder of documents clutched tightly beneath his jacket. He knocks on a plain steel door attached to the back of a dress shop. After a few moments, the door opens. Williams' friend stands in the doorway and tells him to come in. The two walk into the shop's back office, and Williams shakes his head to dry off. His friend asks why he insisted on coming in the back way after closing time. Williams blinks his tired eyes. He explains that his name has been in the papers. He has to assume that Brown and Williamson operatives are following him at all times. He came in the back way to lose any tails. Williams then thanks his friend for allowing him to come here and use the fax machine. He can't afford to be spotted at the local copy shop. His friend gives him a look of concern, but says she's glad to help. She shows him to the fax machine in the corner. Williams carefully slides the folder out from his jacket and begins prepping the documents. They include local newspaper clippings about his theft of confidential memos and the ensuing lawsuit against him. The actual B&W documents are safe for now at his friend's place in Orlando, but Williams still feels a rising sense of desperation. He needs to get these clippings to liability attorney Don Barrett. Williams has read that Barrett is in Mississippi, working on some kind of anti-tobacco case with the state's attorney general and a lawyer named Scruggs. Williams first came across Barrett's name in his collection of Brown and Williamson memos. Barrett had already sued Big Tobacco twice, and his lawyer seemed not to like him very much. That's an encouraging sign, Williams thinks, and hopes Barrett will take his stolen documents, share them with his colleagues, and in return, offer him legal protection. He knows it's a long shot, but it might be his best chance to stay out of jail. William grabs a blank sheet of paper and writes, "I've got something to talk to you about." He signs it, "A cautious friend." Williams then puts the note on the top of his clippings, then inserts the stack into the document feeder. He dials the fax number for Barrett's office, takes a deep breath, swallows hard, and then hits send.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
It's late afternoon, March 1994, and very soon after Merrill Williams clicks send on his fax machine in Louisville. Today, Richard Scruggs is sitting at his broad oak desk in his office in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Legal tomes are shelved on nearly every wall. A framed photo shows Scruggs smiling inside his mansion. Another shows him in the cabin of his private jet. Scruggs is a very successful attorney and has spent his career winning high-profile cases against big business. Scruggs looks down at his legal pad and feels a shiver of anticipation. The notes he's making today may very well help bring the tobacco industry to its knees. He jots down another important fact. There are 200,000 smokers in Mississippi currently on Medicaid. Millions and millions of government dollars are being spent annually to treat these smokers and their tobacco-related illnesses. There is no reason why big tobacco shouldn't be made to reimburse the government for that money. Scruggs looks up from his notes. He's grateful that Mike Lewis brought this case to his attention. Lewis doesn't have the resources or the big trial experience to take a lead role in this fight, but Scruggs intends to make his friend proud and to be part of a team that's going to change the country. The phone rings, and Scruggs picks up. It's his colleague and occasional trial partner, Don Barrett. Scruggs and Barrett recently lost a case against Big Tobacco, and Scruggs knows that Barrett is eager, just like he is, to take another swing. On the phone, Barrett launches into it. He tells Scruggs to fuel up his plane and fly to Jackson. They have a meeting with Merrill Williams. Scruggs asks who Merrill Williams is, but after Barrett spends just a few minutes telling Williams' story, Scruggs is excited too. There's one thing his new case is missing, and that's the proof that Big Tobacco knew its products caused cancer. Williams might be the one who can finally deliver that evidence. Barrett says they need to hurry. Williams wants to meet tomorrow, and Barrett has the sense that the guy is getting more paranoid by the day. It wouldn't be surprising if he went into hiding. Scruggs says he can make that happen, but he also wonders if Williams can be trusted. He could always be a double agent, someone the tobacco industry has sent out to gain information about the case. Barrett's had the same thought, but he thinks it's unlikely. Williams is just too weird to be a double agent. Scruggs will soon see what he means. That's good enough for Scruggs. He hangs up and calls his secretary, asking her to ring the airfield where he keeps his jet. If Merrill Williams wants to meet tomorrow, Richard Scruggs will be on a plane tonight. The next day, Scruggs enters the old-time delicatessen in Jackson, Mississippi. Don Barrett walks beside him. The cozy sandwich shop is filled with young couples and families. Scruggs immediately notices one man, who looks very out of place, though. He sits in the furthest booth from the door, wearing a heavy black sweatshirt and sunglasses. The man looks up and waves. Scruggs looks at Barrett, who shrugs. and the two lawyers make their way over to Merrill Williams. They approach the booth, and Scruggs takes a long look at Williams. He seems hungover. His nose is red, and the smell of liquor is seeping from his pores. Williams gestures for the lawyers to sit. He's apparently been here for some time and pushes a half-eaten meal to the side. Glad you two could make it. I was starting to wonder. Scruggs makes a show of checking his watch. We're all here ahead of schedule, so guess we can get started. It's a pleasure to meet you, Merrill. Now keep your voice down. I don't know who's watching, and there are ears everywhere. Scruggs looks at a nearby table where children are using crayons on their menus.
Okay.
So, anyways, we've done a bit of research on you, and I just want to say that I think you've done a very brave thing, and we're here to help. But first, we'd like to see what you have. Well, I bet you would. Williams leans forward. Tell me something, Scruggs. Are you a cop? Are you working for the FBI? Are you wearing a wire? No, I am not a cop or some kind of agent. I'm a trial attorney. I'm seeking to help you in your fight against Brown and Williamson. We are on the same team. You know, you have to tell me if you're a cop. It's illegal if you don't. We're not cops. Listen, Merrill, I'm losing my patience. I can see that the stress is getting to you, and I sympathize. But I'm not going to go around in circles. You have to trust us. We'll take the documents off your hands, we'll help you get back on your feet, and we'll protect you. And that's my promise. A promise, huh? Well, okay then. I have thousands of secret documents that could destroy Big Tobacco. By the looks of your suits, you're probably pretty wealthy. So how about you fly me to Florida, we pick up the documents, then we fly back. In the meantime, I want you to figure out a safe place to stash all the documents.
Scruggs looks to Barrett. They give each other a quick nod, and then Scruggs looks back at Williams.
Not a problem. I have a bank vault. Of course you do. The documents will be safe.
Good. Then you can expect another call from me.
Hope you have a nice day.
Williams abruptly stands up and, without another word, exits the restaurant and quickly disappears around the corner. Scruggs shakes his head, rubs his eyes, and turns to Barrett.
Oh, Lord. Well, what do you think, Don?
I think he's crazier than hell, but I believe him.
Yeah. What's really crazy is that I believe him, too. And he's right. If he has what he says he has, we might actually win.
It's late afternoon on April 14th, 1994. Jeffrey Wigand sits at his kitchen table in Louisville, Kentucky. He pores over the latest stack of Philip Morris documents that Lowell Bergman sent him. Wigand has a pen and highlighter, and he leaves numerous notes on each page. His vision is blurry. He's been up since 5 a.m. He can't seem to tear himself away from the confidential records. Turns out, Big Tobacco is more corrupt than he ever could have imagined. Wigand's wife, Lucretia, stands silently at the sink, preparing dinner. The scent of onions wafts through the house. Wigand's older daughter sits across from him, watching TV. She asks Wigand if she can change the channel. She's bored by what she's watching. Wigand smiles and tells his daughter that he can't switch channels just yet. What's on TV right now is very important. Because on the screen, Wigand sees his former boss, Tom Sandifer. Sandifer is in Washington, D.C., and takes a seat in front of a panel of congressmen. Quickly, Wigand forgets all about the documents in front of him. His entire energy is focused now on the TV. He watches as Sandifer identifies himself as the CEO of Brown & Williamson and is sworn in for questioning. This week, Congressman Henry Waxman has called hearings in Washington to investigate the health risks of smoking. The heads of the major tobacco companies have been ordered to testify. Today, it's Sandifer's turn for a public grilling. Seeing Sandifer, Wigand is once again filled with loathing. The CEO was a coward and a bully, openly scornful of scientific fact and unapologetically ignorant. Wigand can't believe he worked under such a man for as long as he did. The house Wigand sits in now was bought with the money that Sandifer's company paid him. But to Wigand, more and more it feels like blood money. Wigand leans in, hoping to finally hear his old boss admit the truth. But as he watches, Sandifer tells the congressman,
"Scientific advisors working in Brown and Williamson today advised me that none of the research, I repeat, none of the research, establishes that nicotine is addictive. I've learned nothing that would change my view. I want to assure this subcommittee that we do not spike our products, nor do we manipulate the nicotine in our cigarettes to keep people hooked, as the FDA alleges.
Wigand drops his pen. He was in meetings where Sandifer explicitly said he wanted to increase the nicotine in all B&W products. Sandifer himself had noted that it's nicotine that gets customers hooked and keeps them hooked. And now, Tom Sandifer has perjured himself before Congress and the American public. Wigand looks down at the documents in front of him, then back at the TV. Until now, the idea of taking a public stand against Brown and Williamson was unthinkable. Wigand told himself that the risk was too great, that silence was the only way to protect himself and his family. Now he clenches his jaws, closes his eyes. How can he remain silent after what he just saw today? Wigand knows the truth about Brown and Williamson. If he doesn't speak up, then he's just an accomplice and just as bad as they are. 2 months ago, Jeffrey Wigand told Lowell Bergman, the 60 Minutes producer, that he would not become a whistleblower. Wigand has changed his mind. Next on American Scandal, Mike Moore and Richard Scruggs take their legal battle past the point of no return, and Big Tobacco declares war on Jeffrey Wigand. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of Big Tobacco for American Scandal. A quick note about our reenactments. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, but all our dramatizations are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about the fight against Big Tobacco, we recommend the books The People vs. Big Tobacco by Carrick Mollenkamp, Adam Levy, Joseph Menn, and Jeffrey Rothfetter, and Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up by Philip J. Hiltz. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Hannibal Diaz, edited by Christina Malzberger, produced by Gabe Riven. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Laura Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I love a good parasocial relationship with a celebrity who will probably never know my name.
I mean, honestly, who knows? Don't count yourself out. But my favorite part about these feuds is how they're ignited by the tiniest things.
Jada, I love you. G.I. Jane 2, can't wait to see it.
I accidentally laminated my brows too much.
It starts small and then it gets so big.
To be honest, Naomi, I'm fearful of you to this day.
I don't know her.
We all just have to admit, we're addicted. Everybody has opinions. Everyone picks sides.
Leave Britney Spears alone right now.
From Wondery, I'm Sydney Battle.
And I'm Matt Bellassai.
And this is Dis and Tell, la, 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 where we unpack why we get so invested in these feuds and whether or not our attention only makes the whole thing worse.
Follow Dis and Tell wherever you get your podcasts.